From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for September 3rd, 2017. It's the first Sunday of September. Happy Labor Day weekend, everybody. This is our weekly look at the politics and policies that shape our lives as we go from City Hall to the State House and all the way to Washington, D.C. So time to grab the Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to keep your holiday weekend going off. I can't believe it's Labor Day. I mean, the unofficial end of summer. And I know it always seems that the summer season goes by so fast, but, you know, Dave, this time it really did. There really wasn't a break from work, you know.
No.
The things going on in Springfield, all the things going on in Washington, a gubernatorial campaign on the Democrat side. I mean, it just, there was no kind of rest.
Yeah, and not to mention the fact that past couple of days, it's felt like early fall.
Yeah, and I noticed, you know, this morning coming in how dark it was. You know, it's and you're starting to see, you know, in the afternoon, the way the sun is sitting, it's kind of, you know, what's coming ahead. Kind of, you see the light a little differently. It's, yeah, and I don't feel like I'm weird wearing a Blackhawks hat anymore.
It won't be long. You know? It won't be long. College football here. Sam just talking about scores just now all over the place. Sam, can you explain to me why Michigan and Florida played in Texas?
Not really, no. I think it was
several people and I went talking about that the last few days, but just not sure why.
Well, I think it's for capacity purposes because it was one of the marquee games. I mean, you could fit 100,000 people there AT&T Stadium in Arlington. So tickets, cash.
Yeah, but what is the stadium at Michigan hold?
100,000+. Yeah. That's why they call it the Big House.
But it wasn't a home game; it was a neutral game, so they had to play it somewhere neutral.
Okay, that explains it.
Same reason that Alabama and Florida State they played in Atlanta at the brand new Mercedes-Benz Stadium.
That's quite a place.
And the Chick-fil-A was open because it was Saturday. Have you heard that? There's actually a Chick-fil-A in this stadium in Atlanta.
Well, there would be in Atlanta.
But, Schwani,
they're not open on Sunday.
Right. And so, it's an NFL stadium.
Yeah. It's an NFL stadium. So unless it's a Thursday night game or one of those Saturday games, what's the point?
That's a great question. I'm pulling up the Falcons schedule right now.
Finding out how many games they will
have
be playing.
One game that isn't a home Sunday game. It's a Thursday night game, December 7th. So of all their games, the Chick-fil-A at the Falcons Stadium will be open once.
And you can only imagine what it costs to put that in there, too.
Right.
Nothing comes cheap in these stadiums anymore.
Sir.
Wow. So I watched some of the Alabama-Florida State game. And, I mean, yeah, Alabama just looks crazy tough. But I saw something on my Twitter feed about Howard and UNLV, I think it was.
Howard was a 45-point underdog.
Yeah.
They won outright. They beat UNLV 43-40. That is the biggest upset in modern college football history as far as the point spread goes.
And someone said if you put $100 down on Howard, it would have paid off $55,000.
If you got it earlier, it could have been about $70,000. But yeah, between $50,000 and $70,000, if you would have bet $100 just to win on Howard.
Not that I'm a betting man, mind you, but.
And how about this? UNLV actually paid Howard. If you play a school from, you know, the lower ranks,
right,
you get paid to show up. Howard got $600,000 just to show up play, and then they won.
Ouch!
So that's a double whammy.
Ouch! 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 Well, speaking of Las Vegas, by the way, and obviously with hockey season coming, and I keep an eye. On Twitter. I follow the Vegas Golden Knights, the new hockey team, and the San Jose Sharks posted on Twitter the other day, because there's that big heat wave going on out there, that San Jose already leading Las Vegas because it was 104 degrees. In San Jose, it was 102 in Las Vegas. And the Vegas Knights responded, and we all know how San Jose can hold a lead.
Shots fired.
I loved it. I mean, it was like, all right, they got their social media on. If they can play hockey that well, they'll be something to be reckoned with. And one of my friends, when I retweeted it, said, yes, the Vegas Golden Knights are on the board. So I love it. I love it. Already, you know, all kinds of nasty talk before season.
Is this going to be their second season now?
First
full season.
First,
okay.
Yes, their first full season. And I think the Hawks play there in October.
I still don't like that name. The Golden Knights. With all the possibilities in Vegas, and that's what you come up with?
But the logo looks pretty cool. I mean, they did do a good job with it.
Golden Knights?
I'm not crazy about it. I think it got off to such a bad start, they actually had to buy the rights for the name from some college somewhere.
Central Florida.
Is that what it was?
UCF, the Golden Knights.
Yeah, so, I'm not crazy about the name, but I'm kind of excited for a new team. And like I said, the logo does look pretty cool.
The dice, the snake eyes, the boulevard.
But they couldn't do gambling.
They could.
No.
The Siegfried and Roy's?
Yeah.
You could have done anything but the Golden Knights. Find a Golden Knight in Vegas. It'll be the first one.
Oh. The Siegfried and Roy's. I like that. That would be...
How about the Vegas Gamblers?
See, he said we can't do that, Swanee. He's no fun.
I was talking with Jasmine over here, so I didn't hear you.
No, we could do it. Rick doesn't like it, though.
No, I don't think they would do... They wouldn't take a gambling meme.
You should embrace what's around you, though.
Well, then it'd be like the Vegas Temporaries or something, wouldn't it?
The Vegas Methadones.
Yeah, the Vegas Stays Here. Stay Here. Something like that. Well, all right. So,
what happens in Vegas stays in
yep,
Vegas.
Yep, yep, yes, the Stays Here.
Imagine that on the front of a jersey.
Yeah.
Just a huge rainbow to fit all the font.
All right, so we got NFL season gets started on Thursday night. It's prediction time, folks. What's your Bears prediction? Schwani?
I don't know. Six games? Seven games?
Pick one.
All right, I'll go with seven.
Okay. Sam?
I'll go six. 6-10.
I'm taking six. And not again, you know, I can't believe that they played Trubisky in that fourth game. I still don't understand the concept of that, because we all know what the fourth game is. It's just a cheap money grab for the owners. No starter ever plays. But then to throw him in to that game as a starter, and then after the fourth string quarterback gets injured, bring him in at the end where he almost gets hurt. His entire job I didn't even really watch much of the game, so I read about it, but he was just running safe plays. And, you know, people are booing and whatever. I call it the Groupon game, because I think in the past you could buy tickets.
Tickets on Groupon?
On Groupon for that game. And it's like the game, you take your 5-year-old to and say, now you've been to a football game because you can't afford
the regular season ticket.
Yeah.
Place was half empty.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why they bother with the fourth game. It just doesn't – I understand, but it doesn't make any sense.
Is the when is the first game here, Sam?
Bears-Falcons, Sunday.
It is? Okay. All right.
No Chick-fil-A.
No Chick-fil-A. All right.
Yeah, so word of warning to everybody for traffic purposes next Sunday. Because that'll be full. It's the first game. Bears are in first place.
I can't argue.
Enjoy it while it lasts. I'm not optimistic this year. And I'm just wondering how many games we're going to play before Trubisky gets in. I don't know. I mean, that's really the only thing to watch, I think. And with their wide receiver going out for the season, not real crazy about this season. But anyway, it's Labor Day weekend and barbecues, you know.
And mostly sunny, 86 tomorrow?
Yeah, I mean, I was hearing like near 90. It's to me
summer-like weather.
Yeah, it's well, we haven't
and
had
summer's
any.
Not over yet.
I know, but look at the temperatures that we've been getting.
I know. Yeah, right. Good sleeping weather too. Boy.
It has
into the,
been
into
it
the
has
around
been.
60. Mm.
Yeah, but that rain yesterday kind of snuck up on me. I didn't remember that in the forecast at all.
Yeah, a little line of showers went through about 7:30 last night. Nothing major.
No, but. You know, Taste of Polonia was going on, and everybody's getting rained on out there. The pierogies are getting soggy. You know. But, no, it's beautiful weather. It's a beautiful day today. The sun is shining here on North Michigan Avenue. And we've got a great lineup today. We're going to talk about basically that school funding bill. The compromise bill passing. Governor signing it into law, schools getting funded, the last component of the state budget impasse finally in place. And we'll be speaking with Republican State Representative Avery Bourne of Raymond in southwestern Illinois, and she was one of the negotiators of that compromise bill. She's coming in studio at 7:30. At 8 o'clock, we'll be speaking to my good friend Chris Mooney. He's a political scientist at the University of Illinois at Springfield and a member of the UofI's Institute of Government and Public Affairs. So we'll talk about the school bill as well as some of the politics behind it. And then after the 8:30 news update, we'll be joined by Dan Montgomery. And Dan is the president of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. And we'll talk to him about the final product of that school bill, which includes a controversial $100 million scholarship program that's aided by a $75 million income tax credit. So that's all coming up. We're going to take a quick break now. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Good Sunday morning and welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on a sunny North Michigan Avenue this morning. Time for our weekly spin through national politics. And of course, overnight we've got word of the nuclear bomb test that North Korea conducted, triggering an earthquake. And that's frankly, that was the first kind of signal that anybody had about this. And President Trump, of course, on the Twitter this morning, North Korea has conducted a major nuclear test. Their words and actions continue to be very hostile and dangerous to the United States. North Korea is a rogue nation, which has become a great threat and embarrassment to China, which is trying to help, but with little success. He goes on to tweet, South Korea is finding, as I have told them, that their talk of appeasement with North Korea will not work. They only understand one thing. Now, no one's really quite sure what that talk of appeasement is. And one of the more interesting things is this comes at the same time that there are news reports that the president is looking to suspend a free trade agreement with South Korea. So we'll see how that all comes into play. And obviously, as we do our weekly spin through national politics, we have the president talked a bit last week about his his decision to pardon controversial former Maricopa County, Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, and doing so on a Friday night. And now, thanks to the president, we kind of know what the timing was behind it.
Well, a lot of people think it was the right thing to do, John. And actually, in the middle of a hurricane, even though it was a Friday evening, I assumed the ratings would be far higher than they would be normally. You know, the hurricane was just starting. And I put it out that I had pardoned, as we say, Sheriff Joe. He's done a great job for the people of Arizona. He's very strong on borders, very strong on illegal immigration. He is loved in Arizona. I thought he was treated unbelievably unfairly when they came down with their big decision to go get him right before the election voting started, as you know. And he lost in a fairly close election. He would have won the election, but they just hammered him.
Now, of course, remember that he was convicted in a bench trial of basically from a federal judge. He was ordered to stop profiling. His department to stop profiling. He continued to do so held in contempt by a federal judge, that judge appointed by George W. Bush. Now, the president was in Houston and Louisiana yesterday to meet with victims of the storm and flooding, and most importantly, perhaps, showing some empathy and sensitivity, which was in sharp contrast to his first visit to Texas, where he didn't meet any victims or see firsthand any of the damage. Instead, for a president who loves using superlatives, he found Hurricane Harvey a fitting subject to talk about.
Thank you, everybody. What a crowd. What a turnout.
Harvey sounds like such an innocent name, Ben, right? But it's not innocent.
I will tell you, this is historic. It's epic.
This was of epic proportion. Nobody's ever seen anything like this. It has been an experience really like, unfortunately, we've never had before. There's never been anything like this. Probably there's never been anything so expensive in our country's history. There's never been anything so historic in terms of damage. I said before, the word epic and historic, these are words used to describe this monster known as Harvey. There's never been anything like this. The amount of water. Nobody's ever seen anything this long, and nobody's ever seen this much water. And it's maybe someday going to disappear. We keep waiting.
We love you. You are special. We're here to take care. It's going well. And I want to thank you for coming out.
We have had a tremendous group of folks. The coordination, I think, as much as anything else, everybody's talking about it. The coordination has been beautiful to watch.
Now, also in the news, longtime Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein from California, she faced some complaints from a San Francisco audience when she said that Trump could make a good president.
Look, this man is going to be president, most likely for the rest of this term. I just hope he has the ability to learn and to change. And if he does, he can be a good president. And that's my hope. I have my own personal feelings about it. Yeah, I understand how you feel. I understand how you feel.
Now, the president was also out in Missouri, generically touting a plan for tax reform, though no real details were offered. But he once again challenged Congress on tax reform, the Republican-controlled Congress, and said he didn't want to be disappointed.
So this is our once-in-a-generation opportunity to deliver real tax reform for everyday, hardworking Americans. And I am fully committed to working with Congress to get this job done. And I don't want to be disappointed by Congress. Do you understand me? Do you understand? Understand. Congress. I think Congress is going to make a comeback. I hope so. Tell you what, the United States is counting on it.
Now, there was an interesting moment on the Sunday talk shows last weekend when Secretary of State Rex Tillerson appeared on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace. Tillerson talked about the State Department representing the values of the people of the United States throughout the world. And then he was asked, well, what about the president?
We express America's values from the State Department. We represent the American people. We represent America's values, our commitment to freedom, our commitment to equal treatment of people the world over, and that message has never changed.
And when the president gets into the kind of controversy he does and the UN committee responds the way it does, it seems to say they begin to doubt whether we're living those values.
I don't believe anyone doubts the American people's values or the commitment of the American government or the government's agencies to advancing those values and defending those values.
And the president's values?
The president speaks for himself, Chris.
Are you separating yourself from that, sir?
I've made my own comments as to our values as well in a speech I gave to the State Department.
That's Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with State Representative Avery Bourne, a Republican from Raymond, Illinois, in southwestern Illinois.
This is The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning and welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. And I'm happy to have joining me here in studio this morning, Avery Bourne. She's a Republican state representative from Raymond, and she was one of the final negotiators of the compromise plan that put into place the last puzzle piece of the state budget that was enacted. And we now have funding for our schools with a new general state aid formula, the first revision of that in over two decades. Representative, thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So first, why don't you explain where Raymond is for everybody? And truly, what I like to do is have some of the downstate representatives of both parties in, because I don't think in the diversity that's Illinois and kind of Chicago becomes an echo chamber. And I think it's good for people to kind of get the knowledge of, you know, the rest of Illinois.
Sure. So I represent the 95th district, which is all or parts of four counties south of Springfield. So straight south of Springfield. Raymond has about 900 folks in it. And if you take 55 down to St. Louis, you'll drive right through it.
So off route, does Route 4 go through it?
Nope, but it's right close to where the original Route 66 was. So
there you
Route
go.
66 travels right through the heart of the 95th.
Well, and that'll Dave Schwann, our news man, will be. I'm sure he's been through there because that's part of his kind of travelogue. So, Representative Bourne is the youngest member of the General Assembly, and age and gender really shouldn't matter. And I don't mean it that way, except when I was surprised to discover that I've been covering Illinois politics longer than you've been alive. So, you know, you got appointed and then won election, your first election last year. But what is it about politics and actually at your age, too, being an elected representative in the state legislature in some very, you know, polarizing times?
Yeah, I never expected to be in this position, especially at this point in my life. But we're at a point where especially millennials in Illinois are finding better places where they can have better opportunities. And so I got involved actually before I could vote, getting involved with my local state representative because for a couple reasons. One, my school district that I went to closed and I started looking at where's state money going if it's not going to my kind of downstate small school. And then the other thing is I saw people at the federal and at the state level who were being sent to prison from both parties. I saw Clinton being impeached, and I thought people who represent us should be doing a better job. And so I wanted to be a part of that solution. And it's been quite the privilege to be this involved at this point in my life.
Well, and that's, I was, you know, very much a proponent of that. And I know mandates are supposed to be a bad thing, but I was very much a proponent of the mandate to require teaching civics in our schools because to encourage that kind of engagement, because for the most part, it's people, you know, there is that self-motivation aspect, but also just if you're going to be part of the citizenry and you start at an early age and learn the process, the good and the bad, but there's a motivation factor there. And I just think that's a very important thing. I want to talk about the schools bill, obviously, and I kind of get the sense that it was a lot of the legislators from downstate of both parties that were truly the motivating factor for this, because obviously all the attention up here is about Chicago Public Schools, its funding problems, its junk bond status, all of that. But nobody, I think, up here gets the sense of what's going on in rural Illinois. And schools are just such an integral part, as you know, that was part of your motivation. Schools are such an integral part of community in the way I think you could even say here in Chicago, they're an integral part of neighborhood. And I think that's part of the motivation here to get to work on this formula change.
It absolutely is. So what kind of began this conversation initially, especially among the local superintendents that I have the privilege of representing, was proration. So when education funding was cut, it was cut across the board, which really impacted school districts who are reliant on the state for most of their dollars, which are downstate districts and districts like CPS. And so that's what really got this ball rolling, as they saw disproportionate cuts to school districts who rely on state money the most. So that's what started this conversation. And then really once downstate school districts started to see what they could, the resources they could gain from an evidence-based model and the fairness that that offered, that was a huge reason that a lot of downstate legislators got on board, because they saw how important this could be. As you mentioned, schools are sometimes the biggest employer in the town. A lot of times the source of the town's identities.
I was just going to say that's because when, you know, the post office leaves and the school, I mean, that's a rallying point for these many of these communities.
It absolutely is. And so you got to hear these really heartfelt stories of how we had to invest in education. It goes way beyond education. Educating kids is important, but it goes so much beyond that in downstate districts, as you mentioned.
So in the past, and obviously you know this from researching it, every attempt to deal with the formula was the issue of winners versus losers. And that was always what doomed any kind of plan, because you had the wealthier suburban school districts, which already don't receive much state money. And it was always, well, you're going to have to give, and they weren't going to give, and things just collapsed. And, you know, you go back to when Jim Edgar was governor, and even the issue there of income tax for property tax swap. And part of that was, again, winners and losers. And the unique aspect of this plan is that we now basically have a floor, and it's shooting for a ceiling, but we have a floor of a guaranteed amount of money, the fact that no district loses any money in this new formula.
Yeah, that was an important point of the Governor's School Funding Reform Commission. We got together, and as you mentioned, this has eluded the General Assembly for decades, mainly because they didn't want to pit school districts against each other. And that was one of the first points that we agreed on. If we're going to get anywhere, we can't have pitting of, you know, winners and losers within the state. And so we also recognize, too, that Illinois is last in the nation at supporting our schools from the state level. So we are over-reliant on local property taxes and local schools. And so we decided, yeah, a floor was important. The hold harmless was important. And then we could build moving forward. And so that was one of the reasons, I think, that we got this over the finish line. And I have to commend a lot of people have moved on this issue. And there's been a lot of disagreement about the financial implications of that and how we get to that point. But I think that was an important part of compromise that was the reason that this got done.
Yeah, I mean, and there were some no votes over that issue of future financing. And, you know, there's no guarantees in anything involving politics. The goal is at least the $350 million that's in the budget this year, that'll be an annual, at least minimum, to try to achieve that. But there were no votes over just even that aspect of feeling that commitment without knowing the future was too hard to deal with. But when you hear politicians for many years, for decades, that education's my number one priority, and it just becomes like the F1 function key on the computer. I mean, this was, and it's incremental. You know, I mean, this is not going to change things overnight. It's incremental. But the fact that you, and let's talk about this, this evidence-based model, which I guess is probably more advanced than any other state in the country right now when it comes to deciding the factors of where these state dollars will go. What does evidence-based mean?
Yeah, this is a transformative shift from what we're doing currently. So it takes 27 elements, and we won't get into all of
them. Thank you.
But it takes a look at what each individual school district will need. So it's based off of class size that we're aiming to get to. It's based off of the unique characteristics of a school district, whereas now we just have a foundation level that we're trying to get every student in the state to this foundation level. Well, previously, but now we can look at school districts' individual needs, and we understand that it's costs a different amount of money to educate students in different parts of the state. It takes a different amount of resources to educate students with special needs or students who are in a school with concentrated levels of poverty. There are ways to handle that within this model that we've never had. And what it looks at, too, is in 3 years or in 5 years, if the evidence shifts or if we're seeing different changes, there are ways to alter that so that in the future we have more of a flexible school funding formula than what we've had previously.
So you can weight certain factors a different way, right, and that kind of thing. And I think, you know, that was part of the concern about the governor's rewrite, was certain factors like kind of that geographic element had been taken out of the picture. And I think the governor had concerns about the long-term funding effects of it as well. But the fact that it kind of went beyond, and I know the governor, it was great politics downstate. You know, I took all the bad stuff that's special deals for CPS out. But truly, in over 100 changes that he did, it did strike at some of the more important elements of what you all did on both sides in trying to make this a formula that will last for decades. Is that a fair statement?
So I think that I viewed the governor's mandatory veto as the counteroffer. And so the Senate Bill 1 that we saw in the House had some pretty major changes to some of the elements, too, that we had agreed on in the commission. And so we viewed that as their offer. They didn't consult House Republicans on it.
And that was the Democratic passed plan with Senate Bill 1.
And so I think that the governor's mandatory veto was the counteroffer. And our charge as negotiators and really the leaders, once they got in the room, it was, here's both sides, let's find the middle ground that's going to work for every student. And I think that that's what this compromise deal does. And so I think there were some elements in both Senate Bill 1 and in the governor's mandatory veto that people could point at. And there's a lot of easy ways that you could be a no on this, right? You can point to one thing in this 500-page bill and say that's the reason. But I think when you look at the overall package, this is really going to transform the lives of millions of students who are going to have the opportunity to have a better education because of it.
We're speaking with Republican State Representative Avery Bourne from Raymond in southwestern Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. We're speaking with Republican State Representative Avery Bourne from Raymond, Illinois. She was a member of the final group of negotiators that put together the compromise plan that put into place our new school funding formula, and also getting those checks off to public schools. One of the controversies of this, of course, was the issue of the $100 million program that would offer $75 million in tax credits for people who contribute to a fund that would provide tuition subsidies for students attending private schools. And that prompted kind of the initial rejection led by Democrats from Chicago in the House, concerns over union opposition to that. They got a chance to vote on Senate Bill 1, the original package, to override, and that fell flat. And pretty much I think what the Speaker said was, okay, guys, this is the last train out of town. Either be for it or there ain't going to be one. And I actually thought that this impasse was going to last into September, just as a further political pressure point. And then, of course, I realized that CPS starts on Tuesday. So that might have been a factor to try to move things along as well. But the tuition tax credit issue, mm-hmm. What was the genesis of that? I mean, was that in the commission task force, or where did that actually come from?
So in my conversations with my colleagues in the Senate, I wasn't a part of these conversations, but they said that it came up repeatedly in the grand bargain negotiations.
Okay.
And so that was a topic of some of their conversations. And I will say that for some of us, this wasn't our number one priority in school funding reform, but it was a priority for some of my colleagues in the House. It was a priority for the governor. And I think that when we hear of this opposition, I think there are a lot of falsehoods about what it is or what it isn't that came up in the House. But also, we're talking about $8 billion that we spend on public education in the state. And, you know, there was a lot of rhetoric about if Senate Bill 1 is 90% of what you want, why aren't you supporting it? And we're looking at, I mean, this is 99% of the bill is dealing with the school funding formula that they wanted to fix, and it's very similar to Senate Bill 1. And so I want to commend the leadership of Leader Durkin and Speaker Madigan for saying this is the deal. And this is what's been important to folks in this compromise, and we need to get it done.
But as far as the unions, and you know, and their fear is that this is the camel's nose under the tent for further privatization. And we'll be speaking with Dan Montgomery from the Illinois Federation of Teachers later in the show. But I mean, there has been a recognition in this state of private education being a component, private schools being a component of education in this state, and even researching the tax deduction that exists currently in the state tax forms for kind of an offset for paying for expenses, K through 12 expenses for private school. And when that was upheld by the appellate court, they also signified that, you know, there is a contribution that private schools do contribute, and it's not like a direct subsidy, which would be unconstitutional. And in fact, the opinion was written by Rita Garman, who is now on the Illinois Supreme Court. But when one of the things I thought was interesting is, and this is going a little bit in the weeds, is that the bill is, there is no severability clause in the bill. And so when Chicago Teachers Union talks about going to court and trying to get this ruled unconstitutional, which I'm not a lawyer, but it would appear to me that that's a pretty high bar that they would have to hit. But if they were successful, that would wipe out the whole bill. And that would include no more funding for schools. And so, I mean, that's a significant issue that people ought to consider here.
Yeah, it's totally unconscionable to think that they would risk the entire package that's helpful for every school in the state over a lawsuit. But also, I will say, this is a 5-year pilot program. There's a provision in there that students must take the standardized test across the state. And then there's going to be a review of whether or not there was growth, whether or not it was effective. And these are for low-income families who want the opportunity to go to another school district. I will also say, or to a private school, I will also say under this formula, this is the best possible circumstance, I think, to implement this, because school districts have a per-district hold harmless, which means that if their student decides to go to the private school across town under this scholarship tax credit, that district, if it's underfunded or if it's fully funded, doesn't lose a single dollar for that student leaving, and then they're able to channel those resources to every other student in their district. So if there is an environment to enact this, I think this is a really good environment to do that in, and this is a pilot program. Let's see if it works. If it works, great. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And I think that that's the beauty of this, too. We get to see what the research says at the end.
Well, one, I question if it's ever going to be a pilot program, because once it's there, you know how things go. But the aspect of testing is, I think, a significant one, only because in other states that have this kind of program, there is no kind of evidence-based mm-hmm. kind of requirement to see what effect it's having as far as those students, those individual students. And for the most part, you know, private educators don't necessarily want the State Board of Education poking its nose into what they do. But this is kind of a melding of that to try and measure on a reasonable basis how are those kids doing compared to public school students.
Right, and I think that after 5 years we'll be able to see if those students experienced more growth, less growth, and then we'll actually get to have a real conversation about what happened. But until we have that research, it will be hard to tell. And also, back to your point, I don't think that we should risk the entire we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? We should look at the whole deal. There's an inseparability clause. Let's look at it after 5 years.
You're too young to be using those old cliches. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Do you think with this compromise, has the legislature turned a corner here in getting things done? Or is this because schools are so important and through the whole impasse, everybody knew that there's something, you know, the schools were a third rail and you can't really mess with them. I mean, do you see any kind of cohesion going on here, or is this just kind of, everybody had to do this and then we're going to be back to the same battles?
I really hope that this lays the groundwork for more bipartisan major reforms. I think, and I've talked to folks who've been in this longer than me, this is the most meaningful bipartisan legislative reform, I think, in decades. And so if we can take that and build on it, I see a path where we can get a lot done. And you're right, schools are very important. And everyone campaigns saying that they are for education and they're for getting this right. And I think we did that. And if we can build on that, I think there's some important, more important work to be done.
But the next thing is getting those incremental, at least incremental, that's the low bar, more funding. Because unless we ever get to a point where we can make that shift from state funding, and of course, you know, your districts downstate get a much higher percentage of state dollars than the suburban districts do. And we all know what the property taxes are like, you know, out in the burbs. But for and there is a provision for some of these districts that have met adequacy level that by referendum they could vote for a 10% property tax cut. Although, quite frankly, I bet a lot of them don't do it because part of the reason of living in those districts is the schools, and that's what gets their property values. And yeah, school funding by zip code is, as I've said before, is a 17th century measure of agrarian wealth. And determining the quality of schools by zip code, that isn't the way to do it.
And I'm glad you mentioned prioritizing education spending over other dollars in the state budget. And that's actually, there's a provision in this bill called the minimum funding level that we've had some disagreements about. But I think the beauty of it is it says if we don't reach that goal in future years, then the money, all of the new money goes to the school districts who need it most first. So if we're filling from the bottom up, we're going to fill those who need more money first, and then we will move on to school districts who are more well-funded. And so I think you will see school districts in the suburbs who are maybe closer to being fully funded, they will want some of those new dollars. So they will be pushing as well to meet that funding goal. So that's not what we've had in the past. In the past, we've had rural school districts and places like Chicago advocating for more money, but the suburbs maybe haven't. And so I think this gets everybody moving in the same direction so that we can meet that goal every year.
That's Avery Bourne. She's State Representative Republican from Raymond, Illinois. Thank you so much for joining
Thanks
me this morning on the
me.
Sunday Spin. Where it's time for a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue, a sunny North Michigan Avenue. And it turns out this is just going to be a beautiful day and a great Monday with forecast highs near 90. Just a fantastic way to celebrate, I guess, the unofficial end of summer. And of course, we've got the Jazz Fest going on, and I know one of the great fans of the Jazz Fest is my next guest, my good friend Christopher Mooney, a political science professor at the University of Illinois at Springfield and part of the University of Illinois' Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Chris, thanks for joining me this morning.
Yeah, my pleasure, Rick.
So we've just been talking to Republican State Representative Avery Bourne, who is part of the negotiators among the negotiators of the compromise plan on school funding. And, you know, the last kind of component of the end of the budget stalemate that lasted over 2 years. And, of course, just like that budget stalemate and the factors behind it, the school funding issue was kind of a subset of that, with some of the kind of the same issues going on, of issues involving organized labor, issues about state funding. And, you know, it was good to see a rare bit of, I guess, compromise here, and something, I wasn't sure was going to happen until perhaps later in September.
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable. And you know, anytime they revamp the school funding formula, it's a major accomplishment, because you know, it doesn't happen very often, and it's one of the most difficult things to do, because it affects every single state rep and senator's district in a real, you know, visceral way, because schools are so vital to you know, the fabric of society. And I think you really hit on it in the last segment when you talked about the difference, you know, the fact that they've, in a sense, held harmless all the districts. They said, look, you know, nobody's going to lose. It's just who's going to gain more. And that was, you know, an important component of this, because when you ask a state rep to vote on something that's going to hurt their district, it's a very difficult ask. And in this way, at least, you know, the idea is that nobody's going to be any worse off, but some districts are going to be better off. That's a little bit easier for them to take, I think.
Yeah, and in the past, that was always the problem, was that it was mm-hmm. winners versus losers. And, I mean, the last time when Governor Edgar tried to do the property tax for income tax swap, that was with the Republican legislature, and they didn't go for it. And part of the reason was you already had the suburbs that felt that they were already paying for the rest of the state, in essence, and now you're talking about taking even the minuscule money, state money, away from their schools.
Yeah, it's a perception thing. The fact that you're not getting more, or you're getting less now, you're not going to get more in the future. I mean, it's not anything more than something that's going to it's a perception issue. For example, I mean, just because the suburbs aren't getting more or aren't getting less now, I mean, they're going to get less later. So it just allows, them to get past that problem and really get at the root problem, and that is the inequity of the system. And it comes down to some real basic question of of fairness, and what do we think, at what level do we think schools ought to be equalized in this country? And so, for example, right now, if you're in a school in a school district, I mean, maybe CPS aside, because there's so many magnets and whatnot, but I mean, the kids are getting largely the same education within a school district, and also within states. I mean, we say, like you were mentioning before, that why should the quality of kids' education depend on the zip code? Well, we don't say there's a problem with why should the quality of a kid's education depend on the state, right? Because the state, if you move from Illinois to Missouri or from Missouri to Kentucky, we think that's a legitimate difference there. Whereas just because somebody's living in DuPage County versus Massac County, we don't think there's somehow the idea that that's unfair if those schools are not equal because they're within the state. And some, on the other hand, say that, if we're well off and we can afford to buy a very nice house in a very nice area and we value schools more highly, we're willing to tax ourselves more to pay for, better schools, pay teachers more, have a pool sort of thing, then that's okay, and that's a person's right. That's kind of the fundamental debate, I think.
We're speaking with Chris Mooney. He's a political science professor at the University of Illinois at Springfield. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm speaking to Chris Mooney, my good friend from the University of Illinois at Springfield. We're talking about the passage of the compromise school funding package, the final component of the enacted budget in the state of Illinois. And I don't know about you, Chris. I just thought this thing might drag out a little bit more into September just for, kind of the political pressure.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a hard thing to do. It's like with the budget, nothing. I always tell my students, shockingly, lawmakers are human beings, and human beings don't do anything until the last minute, whenever they can avoid it, right? And, the atmosphere down there has been so rancorous. Not just this last few weeks, but I mean, really for almost going on three years now, right? Or 2.5 years. And nothing seems to have gotten done without an incredible amount of pain, an incredible amount of pressure. And this was one that didn't quite make it there. And it's also one that was done. I think it really showcased, and it was interesting that you had Representative Bourne on, I think it really showcased some of the best of the future of the state legislature. And you never know what's going to happen as time goes on, of course, but state reps like Avery Bourne, who's a young, very intelligent, hardworking sort of policy wonk, and then a couple of senators that were really in the weeds on this for several years and driving. Andy Menard is a senator from Bunker Hill who actually Avery Bourne is one of his reps in his area. And then he's a Democrat from down there. And Bunker Hill is, again, on the way to St. Louis from Springfield. And then Jason Berrickman, who is a Republican state senator from
Bloomington.
He calls himself a Bloomington, yeah, Pontiac, that kind of area down there. And they've been working hard on it for a long time. And they are, you know, again, bright, hardworking, kind of shiny pennies, working, you know, at the sort of wonky level, trying to get this thing taken care of. And, you know, that gives me them, and, you know, just as examples, but it gives me hope for the future because, you know, the people, you know, the old guys like us, they just seem to be doing nothing but beating each other's heads against the wall for, you know, one inch of political advantage. And that's not a great way to run a state.
Well, and, I you know, yes, we are the graybeards, but I can't really think, despite all the work it took to get this bill, I still don't think that this means is any kind of precursor that, you know, this is a rare kumbaya moment. And now that's been taken care of, and now we're going back into the same battles.
Well, that's probably true, but I'm just thinking, you know, sort of long term and in grasping for straws. I mean, that we've all been,
yeah, yes,
you know, last couple of years. I mean, what good is kind of come out of this? I mean, it's been nothing but bad. And really, there was a, you know, just even on the school bill. I mean, they pulled that out of the fire because just at the last minute, more or less. I mean, the governor came in with a, you know, with a mandatory veto, which was really, you know, seen as a, I think generally seen as a quite an overreach on the part of the governor and his new staff, and raised all sorts of queries. And I think that may have been what helped move this thing over the finish line as well, is that, you know, the governor in some sense, I mean, I think Representative Borden was, you know, it was kind to say, well, they saw this as a counteroffer. But, you know, I think it was a little bit more than that. And I think it was a little further than a lot of these legislators, especially downstate Republican legislators. They said, look, this is getting crazy here. You know, we've got to, you know, let's keep things under control. Let's move this along and get it done so the kids can go back to school. And, you know, the governor, you know, to his credit, you know, they tossed up that alternative or that, you know, other, you know, the amendatory veto, and he backed off on it pretty significantly. And of course, you know, we get the little digs. I think it was Rahm who pointed out at the signing ceremony that this, you know, he one of the main things that the governor was upset about the first bill was he called it a Chicago bailout, which he loves to do when he's south of I-80. But then the Chicago public schools actually got more money in the final version than they did in the original version. You know, I get the feeling that that was just a little stiff middle finger to the governor from the speaker, I got a feeling.
Well, and you know, I have to tell you, and I wrote in Friday's paper that, you know, when you look at what the Democrat passed Senate Bill 1, and then you had the governor's rewrite of it, and what did he get out of it? I mean, you're right, because frankly, what helped motivate this compromise was the fact that as he went downstate and said, and frankly, even just, you know, a couple of weeks ago down at Republican Day at the State Fair, he says, well, the only thing I did with this bill was take out the special deals for Chicago. And that's not true. I mean, and it was, frankly, it was that overreach, I think, that helped the Republicans. And even remember this, he was asked about, well, what about having people sit down and do a compromise? And the governor's first words were, he laughed. And it's like, sit down and talk? And then that got ridiculed. And the next day he's directing the Republican legislators, please go talk to your Democratic counterparts in the legislature. I mean, he got nothing out of this.
Yeah, he's been flailing around a little bit, you know, trying to get his feet under him. I think he's got this whole new staff. I know you've talked about on the show, and is it that they're trying to figure out, oh, now we actually have to govern here rather than send out press releases, and what does that mean? Or the governor just getting tired? I mean, he's been in a long battle in an area that he is not an expert in. You know, he's a guy who comes from the private sector, and you know, he's not used to this kind of political battle, which takes place, you know, both inside and outside of, you know, spheres of power. And maybe he's just getting tired. I mean, he doesn't look good. He said he lost 20 pounds. It didn't seem like he had that much to lose to start with. And, you know, so
he has to adjust the Carhartt jacket size now.
There you go. Yeah, it's a tough job, and he's coming to now. The one thing he maybe, I mean, you might say, well, one thing he did get out of it is the private school scholarship fund, which you're going to hear about. Or I guess you guys are going to talk about in a minute. You know, and that's something that's near and dear to his heart. He's been a school choice charter school guy forever. That's kind of how he got into politics, and so you know, you might that might be the bone.
That seemed to be more a priority of Republican legislators. I'm not sure it came from him. It sounded
I don't
like
think it did.
No, and so you know, he kept pounding property tax freeze, which of course, you know, valid questions. Nobody likes property taxes, but how does a property tax freeze affect school funding when schools are still so dependent on it? What do you get out of it? This 100 and some districts maybe in the state that are wealthy districts, that it makes it easier for an effort to reduce their property taxes, except as I said to Representative Bourne.
Not that easy.
In those districts, probably the voters there, you know, they're the ones that support property tax increases for their schools, recognizing the trade-off of the value, the property value and the property taxes. You know, it enhances the property values. So is that likely to happen? I have serious questions. I mean, all of the governor's priorities, you know, even in longer term priorities, there's nothing in this bill that really reflects that. I think the only thing he might truly privately point to is the fact of treating charter schools as part of the funding, you know, that public schools get, and charter schools has always been his big kind of thing. But you know, you ask him, what did you get out of this? I think what he got out of it was he signed a bill. And
well, exactly. He's learned how to win a little bit here, and maybe likes the fact that, oh, we got something accomplished. And so maybe that will be the benefit to him, and he'll understand that you don't have to get 100% of everything you need to win and to help to move, you know, to progress on public policy in a way that, you know, when you have a consensus that something is problematic, like the school aid formula, and you can solve it. I mean, this is an historic bill. I mean, it's not a perfect bill, but it's a big one. And, you know, he can take credit for that because he signed it, and there he was. And if he's smart, he will take credit for it and move on, and maybe they'll be able to you know, address some of these other problems in a bipartisan manner. But the problem, of course, is they're going to start circulating petitions for elections for 2018. You know, relatively soon.
Tuesday.
Which means, yeah, it's that's right, it's Tuesday already. Yeah, and that you know, so the next election is coming, and it's not going to be pretty.
Boy, that's putting it mild.
It's not that pretty already.
Thank you very much. That's my good friend Chris Mooney, political science professor, University of Illinois at Springfield, and a member of the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Chris, thanks so much for getting up with me this morning.
Yeah, my pleasure. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Dan Montgomery. He's the president and chief operating officer of the Illinois Federation of Teachers.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning and welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. The National Rifle Association has launched a new round of digital ads featuring paid conservative commentator Dana Loesch. In the ad, this latest one, she gives a controversial warning to the New York Times.
We the people have had it. We've had it with your narratives, your propaganda, your fake news. We've had it with your constant protection of your Democrat overlords, your refusal to acknowledge any truth that upsets the fragile construct that you believe is real life. And we've had it with your pretentious, tone-deaf assertion that you are, in any way, truth or fact-based journalism. Consider this the shot across your proverbial bow. We're going to fisk the New York Times and find out just what deep rich means to this old gray hag, this untrustworthy, dishonest rag that has subsisted on the welfare of mediocrity for one, two, three more decades. We're going to laser focus on your so-called honest pursuit of truth. In short, we're coming for you.
Okay. That's the National Rifle Association. Addressing the New York Times. Now, look, you don't have to agree necessarily with the New York Times, but when you have the National Rifle Association saying, we're coming for you, take it for what it's worth. Well, switching gears, we've been talking about the school funding bill this morning, and finally a bit of bright spot as we've completed now the final piece of the state budget process, and schools are getting funded. And joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Dan Montgomery, the president of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. Dan, thanks so much for joining me.
It's great to be here, Rick. Thank you.
So, I mean, it's, as everybody kind of points out, in a compromise, you don't get everything you want. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly when we saw Senate Bill 1, which was the Democrat-passed plan,
right.
You know, that was one where you, I think I was surprised at the amount of support that existed, quite frankly, from superintendents throughout the state.
Mm-hmm.
And then we saw the governor do his rewrite, which I actually think was a true motivating force for Republicans and Democrats to come together, more so for the Republicans, because I think if you look at the changes that he made, when the Republicans figured out that it was not just, as he said, removing that Chicago bailout, right, as he called it, that there were other factors in this bill that in many instances would have gutted some important factors in this evidence-based, you know, formula change,
mm-hmm,
that's they said we can't live with those changes.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, in effect, they did override the governor's veto. I mean, they didn't do it, you know, it wasn't a legal vote of an override, but, you know, they passed a new bill that restored virtually everything he overrode.
And more.
And more. Yeah, that's right. And so, yeah, I mean, it was a total rejection of the governor. I mean, most states that have revised school funding, you see the governors leading on this because it's, as you pointed out already today, it's an extremely difficult thing to do. I mean, how many years have you been covering this story about Illinois' messed up school funding?
If you want to see the file drawer that I have all of the...
Okay.
You don't want to see it. Trust me.
But yeah, I mean, so he did an extraordinary thing. And as you kind of also got into earlier with Representative Bourne, you know, there were a lot of legislators that have worked on this for years. Andy Menar, in particular, someone who had really pushed the envelope and kind of forced this into the sphere of discussion. You know, I serve on this thing called EFAB, the Educational Funding Advisory Board. And the old formula was so complex. It was like a Rube Goldberg. You know, it had just been layer upon layer upon layer of changes to fix problems that, you know, when they underfunded education, which is what they've done in the last few years, it did. It punished the poorer schools first. I mean, it was a perverse, perverse system. So, you know, as a teacher, let me tell you, I mean, with something for years we've been sort of scratching our heads about and saying, we not only, you know, is there not enough money going into K-12 education and higher ed too, by the way, but that's another story. It's so inequitable. We had, by any measure, the most inequitable school funding system in the country. Our richest schools, the distance between our richest schools and our poorest school districts was as high as anywhere in the country. And so that was just morally wrong. It's just wrong. And that's one of the things to me that was so frustrating about the governor's. And I'll say it. I mean, I felt his it was sort of a racist dog whistle to walk around this, to go downstate in southern Illinois, central Illinois, and say this is a Chicago bailout.
But he did it here, too. And frankly, I think that was a effort to try to appeal to suburbanites.
Yes, exactly. And it was so, well, one, it was untrue. Two, as you pointed out, look at the results of the bill. It had more money for Chicago than the original version he vetoed. So I think you're right. I think his sort of way overreach on the veto did motivate people. You know, if he had somehow rejected that compromise, they would have overridden his veto. And it would have been a political, I mean, I'm not sure he can recover from this summer anyway. And I think he certainly wouldn't have been able to if that had happened.
Well, and I also kind of get the feeling that it was the Republican leaders in the legislature that basically told the governor, you got to take this. And frankly, those Republican legislators, rank and file legislators, they needed something to take home.
Yeah. And I think on the Democratic side, you had liberal and centrist Democrats saying, we got to get something done. And, you know, you heard, I mean, that the first vote, I mean, a lot of them expressed their displeasure at the tax credit issue.
Right.
And I think in the end, they were feeling that they can't go back to their districts and say, we don't have school funding. You know, we're going to miss another school payment, which, you know.
Which we had never done before in the state.
Yeah.
And we missed two of them.
And it is true. And this is where, you know, you had superintendents and school boards saying, we need this bill. They were in real crisis. I mean, we, you know, 2/3 of them are in not good financial shape. And so, you know, they all opened and were able, but there were some of them really on the edge who wouldn't have been making payroll without that next payment.
Most likely. And said, we don't know how long we can stay open.
Right.
And I mean, and as I've said, you know, so many times, I always thought schools would be a trigger issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And because Rauner had sort of relented in earlier budget battles and sort of
right, and when he vetoed the whole budget except for K-12 funding, that kind of was an indicator there of the political pressure point that schools were.
Yep. Let me, you know, make one other point here, and that is one of my concerns is that, you know, your listeners and other people in the state will think, oh, great, well, we fixed school funding. Well, we did in one very important way, and that is, you know, the bill they passed is really just a formula for, you know, whatever monies we put in, this is how we distribute it. And so it's much more equitable. You know, the poorer districts are going to get more money first, and that's right, and that's as it should be. And as you pointed out earlier, no district's going to lose under this. However, it's still dependent on the dollars they put in.
Right, and that's why I term it as incremental, because you know, the goal is at least $350 million in new money each year in the formula, which is what is going in at this time.
Right.
But that's a goal.
It's a goal. And to be clear, what that means is in the aggregate, the bill is about, well, school funding is about $4 billion with a B, dollars off what this evidence says we should be putting in from the state for education. So, and you heard Will Davis, I know, on the floor when he was talking about this, and he was the House sponsor of the bill, said, you know, it's basically arbitrary. He was asked, how did you come up with this number, $350 million? He said, well, we know we're about four, maybe a little bit more billion off. We just took $3.5 billion, divided it by 10. So it is an arbitrary measure or calculation of how to put money in. So we need more money. We need, and this points to the state's broader fiscal problems, right? We don't, as tough as it is for on a lot of people's property tax bills, the state end is, we're low tax state and we've got a problem meeting our obligations. So that has to be resolved. This governor, I believe, is never going to resolve that. So I think the next governor will.
Well, no surprise where you're coming from there. We're speaking with Dan Montgomery, President and Chief Operating Officer of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
There will not be another generation of students that are subjected to inequity, the worst in the country, after this bill becomes law. That's something worth saying today. It may not be perfect. It is not perfect. But is this a moment that we should all grab and we should all take a hold of and we should all celebrate together? Understanding there's work to do and there's accountability that has to take place afterwards, the answer is absolutely without question in my mind.
That's State Senator Andy Menar, who's been on this program, Democrat from Bunker Hill in Macoupin County, who was kind of the lead player when it comes to the whole issue of this whole new school funding formula that we've adopted. We're speaking with Dan Montgomery, the president of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. And as I said, there's the good, but as far as the unions are concerned, there's the bad. And it's a tuition tax credit for private school students, this program. And actually, we've got a call from Ron.
Sure.
Ron, welcome to the Sunday Spin. Hold on, Ron. We're getting to you here.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. You know what? And I support the tax scholarship program. But and this is my question, Dan. How do you respond to people who look at the opposition to that and vouchers as the perception that it's really just about jobs? Let me give you two examples. There is not opposition to vouchers in housing. Matter of fact, there's very little housing being built. And lastly, the same thing with the what these call the food stamp program. You can take those vouchers. You can shop anywhere you want to go. You can live it when you go. So my thing is, there is just a perception that opposition to parents like myself who like to have choice is mainly about jobs, not about children's education.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Ron.
Yeah, thanks for that question. You know, well, I can say that I think the longstanding opposition of educators and teachers unions and others, by the way, to vouchers is really based, unlike the other examples you had, on the notion that we would have public dollars going to sectarian efforts, you know, especially religious schools. And there's, you know, that's been a long, bright line in this country for a long time that is part of our social contract and it's part of our constitutions, both federal and in many states specifically, including Illinois. So I think that's the difference. You know, it's not that way in every country. In Canada, when you pay property taxes in Canada, you can check a box that directs some of it to the Catholic school if you want. But that's not part of our, you know, social compact here. And that's a widely held belief. So, you know, with the voucher battle that you're seeing here, you saw it a kind of like a little snippet of basically in Illinois. But it's really blown up big time with the appointment of Betsy DeVos, you know, by any measure, an unqualified education secretary whose really only claim to fame is that her family's donated hundreds of millions of dollars to the Republican Party, mostly to push vouchers. And if you look at Michigan, which is where they've invested the most money, the DeVos family, they have about the worst record in terms of vouchers and charter schools of any state in terms of, you know, the performance of children. So I think our values are fundamentally public education is a public good. It's public dollars. It should stay in the public realm for all children equally. You know, nothing against private schools or sectarian schools. That's great. And people love them. And you know, we've got the largest Catholic diocesan school system in America right here in Chicago. If it's not the largest, second largest. So a lot of people have that value. That's fine. We just don't think public dollars need to support it.
And so the kind of the way to the skates around the prohibition is by it's a tax credit.
Right.
75 cents on the dollar, maximum contribution, $1 million. Be $100 million program, $75 million in tax credits out. It skates through the kind of prohibition because the courts have basically ruled that a tax credit is not money that the government already has and is giving back.
Right.
It's people keeping more of their own money.
It's the government's foregoing some income. Yeah, I mean, and I think it is important in this bill, the way they wrote it, that $75 million revenue loss to the state of Illinois doesn't necessarily go directly to schools. It's just in their general revenue fund will be reduced by $75 million. For us, that was actually part of the problem because if you look at Illinois' big fiscal system.
Yeah, is this a time to be losing revenue?
Is this exactly? And you know, on you kind of the balance here, the balance of equities or the balance sheet, you had this, you know, once in a lifetime generational chance to do the right thing for every kid in this state. You know, when we have an inequitable system, it harms a kid in East St. Louis and it harms a kid in Chicago at the same time. You know, and when that kid in East Chicago is harmed, I think it's a harm to the kid in Chicago and vice versa. So it changed that. really the price for that had to be giving a tax break to, let's face it, wealthier people are going to get the tax break. If you only have the tax break if you have the money to donate. And in fact, you point out up to $1 million. So that seemed like really an unfair requirement. You know, I had heard that that was the governor's price tag for signing it. It might have been. But, you know, that's just not good public policy in Illinois right now when, you know, the state, as we said a minute ago, what, $350 million out of the $4 billion they have to put into fully fund education. So we didn't think that was a fair bargain.
Well, and, I mean, you had Representative David Harris, Republican, on the floor saying he couldn't vote for the compromise over that $75 million, and not because he necessarily disagreed with the concept. Yeah. It was just, do we really want to be taking revenues away from the state of Illinois right. at a time when you have, you know, $130 billion in pension liability, yep. a $14 billion backlog of state bills?
Right.
And, yeah, we do have a budget now,
yeah.
and we're able to spend money,
yeah.
but we still got to catch up on some of this, and let's even look at the public schools. I mean, they were $1 billion backlog bills for them
right.
during this
yes.
impasse.
Oh, totally. Actually, more than a billion. We were hitting 1.1 billion. And
oh, I don't want to short you that.
Yeah,
no, the
exactly.
point one.
I mean, a billion here and a billion there. Yeah. Pretty soon you're talking real money. So yeah, well, you got that exactly right, and I think that you know. You step back and again, you look at the larger fiscal picture of the state. This feels good to have the school funding bill and, you know, hopefully we are on the track where we had more money. But boy, there's a lot of work to do to right the fiscal ship still. I wanted to make one other point too, you know, as we talked about this bill and where we were going to be on it, our higher ed folks made a really great point. They were outraged. They were outraged when they saw this tax credit because, you know, we've had now a 20-year plus corrosion of higher ed funding in the country that has the greatest educational system in the world, the greatest university system, and in Illinois, a fantastic system. Well, you know, they are right now in terms of dollars. I mean, we're at like 1995 levels and slipping state dollars for our schools. So, and you see the effect on tuition and people can't afford to send their kids to state colleges now. And then look what, you know, has happened in the last couple of years here where we've got Governor State, Chicago State, and others kind of on the brink of insolvency because the state's not giving them the money they need. MAP grants, college tuition funding for poor kids, you know, on the brink. They, you know what $75 million could have done added to the MAP grant program? So our higher ed people looked at that and said, really? I mean, really? Like, we $75 million tax break for wealthy is what it takes to do this. And they calculated that was grossly unfair, and I agree.
Well, and, you know, I remember, and I think I've told this story before, when Blagojevich actually was governor. And up till him, any new dollars that came into the state, it was generally one-third higher ed, two-thirds K through 12.
Yeah.
Blagojevich comes in, his first budget. And I said, whatever happened to the one-third, two-thirds rule? And he said, what are you talking about?
Really?
And that was, I think, kind of the end of that.
Yeah.
And that's,
yeah.
And frankly, from that point on, higher ed has never been the same.
It's never been the same.
And
no,
then you
true.
Take the last 2 years and all the problems that, you know, higher ed, like Southern Illinois and some of those
yeah.
places, that's going to take them years to recover from.
It is. Exactly. And they've lost. We've heard story after story of them, of tenured professors leaving because they're getting better offers from other schools in the Midwest or other parts
well,
of the
and
country.
Also had certainty.
And certainty. Exactly.
That's Dan Montgomery, president of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. Dan, thanks so much for joining me this
Always
morning.
Always great to be here, Rick. Thank you.
We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, State Representative Avery Bourne, Chris Mooney from the U of I, and Dan Montgomery from the IFT. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening and hope you're all getting ready for a great rest of this Labor Day holiday weekend. And I'm going to be hitting the grill. I don't know about you, Dean.
I probably will be doing some grilling at some point. I don't have anything planned right now. I like to grill freestyle.
Okay.
I like to.
I don't know what that means.
I'll figure out at the last minute. Am I going to grill today? Am I not?
It's not a fashion thing.
What's in the? No.
Yeah. Okay. Thank
you. That sounds like I could wind up in the hospital.
Yes. Yes.
No. It's not. Sometimes you just you look in the fridge and what's in there and what am I going to?
Well, I've been ribs have been marinating in the 17th Street Magic Dust Dry Rub.
Ooh.
So those are going to be hitting the grill, and I got also prepped my blue cheese bacon coleslaw.
Oh, look at you! You're dragging out all the good stuff.
Well, it is the end of summer. Right?
I don't like to think of it that way.
I can't help but think of it that way.
Don't you grill in the winter?
Well, I do, but I don't necessarily do the bacon blue cheese coleslaw and all of that kind
Why
of
not?
Stuff. The one regret I have, I did want to do pulled pork, and the thing is to do it right. It's 12 hours.
You needed to start 5 days ago.
Well, see, I could have started it when I got up this morning. It's just who's going to tend the thing while I'm down here at the radio
station. It
takes
a long time. I had the same bug a month ago. I haven't done pulled pork in a long time. I'm going to do pulled pork. And then I went to the store and I start thinking about how much time this takes.
And it's not the work. It's the time.
It's the time. It's really actually really simple,
yeah.
But you've got to have a lot of time. Then I thought there's a perfectly good barbecue restaurant right down the street. I can get as much pulled pork as I want there in about 5 minutes. So
yeah,
that's
still,
what I went with. And that's why I decide at the last minute.
Okay, that explains freestyle.
Yeah, that's freestyle. That's my freestyle.
It's either light
barbecue.
The grill or go to the barbecue joint. That's the freestyle.
And both are equally as pleasurable.